You're tuned to my radio at stanpelke.com. This is Stan Pelke, your host, and I'm so pleased you've joined me for the 15th podcast featuring readings from my original novel, Project Earth, Dawn of Defiance. With this podcast, I launch the second half of the novel. The episode that follows consists of Interlude 3 plus the first part of Chapter 8. You are in for more surprises, both in the story and the music. If you are enjoying these podcasts and my novel, please encourage others to join us. All episodes are currently available on the My Radio page. Interlude 3. Can you picture them? The docent asked the assembled group. Organics, cybernetics, and floating remote ocular probes transmitting signals back to users, resting in virtual reality sarcophagi, worlds away, or patching in from starliners passing between the inner and the outer solar system. They are shells, husk-like figures in billowing robes of faded red cloth, and they would have been lining up in preparation for their assembly, right there where you are standing, or floating, now. Picture them. White, powdered faces are expressionless. There is silence, but for the quiet whisper of forced air moving through the stone passageway here, where the acolytes would have gathered. No one speaks. No one sings. Torchbearers as old and as wizened as the acolytes approach and move to the front of the line, and then all is ready. The docent turned and pointed gracefully down the stone passageway. Once the gathered host was ready, they would have passed silently down to the assembly hall. Come now, follow me. The tourists began to process, silently, like the long-dead men with painted faces. Just as in ancient days, there is silence but for the whisper of moving air down the long, long corridor. They processed nearly a kilometer from the gather point to the great wooden door that blocks the passageway from the assembly hall. Here, at the entrance to the assembly hall, the docent continued in hushed tones, the presider would have venerated the great wooden door and its gilded images of the gene givers. Then, having been presented with credentials of merit, the wardens of the door would have swung wide the great wooden door for the acolytes.
Is it true that the wardens wore old, rusting, and dented armor that was older even than the oldest text memory?
One organic asked. The docent nodded. You can see one surviving suit of armor in the museum above, but among the final records of the monastery, it says that long before the end, the armor of the wardens of the door was old beyond reckoning. As if on cue, four figures dressed in beaten replicas of the warden's armor emerged from alcoves and heaved open the great wooden door. Even after so long, stale air poured out into the passageway, but no one flinched from the smell. All remained quiet as the lingering creak of the door hinges touched ears and probe microphones.
With due reverence, the docent whispered,
the gathered host would then pass into the assembly hall. All would touch the gilded images as they passed in. Come. The company passed through the opening. A few reached up to touch the great wooden door, but its gilded images were long since worn away by countless generations of long-dead worshippers. The darkness inside was almost complete, except for the pale light sneaking in from the passageway now behind the group.
Please remember to keep personal illumination devices off,
the docent whispered as the final guest passed into the assembly hall. More reenactors appeared and took up stations around the great dais. Soon, a torchbearer stood at each corner, and four acolytes formed a semicircle behind each torchbearer.
Once at their stations, the docent continued, the presider would move to the dais, offer silent prayers of thanksgiving, and then start the first great hymn. It is recorded in the Book of Rubrics that many minutes might pass between the silent prayer and the first song, but then a low moan would have escaped the presider's mouth. Picture it. Expressionless eyes stay fastened to the foot of the dais nearest the presider's feet. The moan grows into a low tone. Words form. Acolytes join in, some on melody, some on countermelody, some on simple parallel interval drones. The melody is slow. The singing labored. The torches flicker. The first song ends and a second begins. Low moaning transposes into subtle, slithering melodic shape. Rhythms remain static.
The docent fell silent as recorded music, a best approximation of the ancient songs, filled the room.
After the first song, the acolytes would sing all of the stanzas of the hymn of purification. We know this from the Book of Rubrics, but the text is lost. Given the hymn's importance, we must assume it was so sacred that it was taboo to write down the text, and that each new acolyte had to learn it by memory.
A few more reenactors passed among the silent crowd. As the recorded song ended, two reenactors near the head of the dais drew small flasks of oil from their robes and slowly made their way up the three steps of the dais.
At this point in the ceremony,
the docent began again,
the presider would also ascend the stairs, and a third song would have begun. The acolytes would unfasten the stoppers on their flasks and begin to anoint the heads of those resting on the dais. We cannot have you approach, but you can still see what remains of the sacred resting forms of the gene givers. The presider would have ministered to them, and other acts of care and praise would have been given.
He sighed and turned to face the assembly.
The presider would then move among the resting forms, ritually straightening clothing that even in the last days would have nearly been rotted away with age and exposure to the outside air. The presider's pale, powdered face would remain expressionless as he sang, as he recited prayers and incantations, as he blessed the bodies. Oils would have been applied to what was left of heads.
I have read that seven ancient bodies were entombed in the assembly hall, and that seven ancient bodies were venerated, but I only see six here.
A cybernetic spoke quietly to the docent.
True,
the docent replied.
We do not know when the seventh body disappeared, or where it may have been taken.
Are there theories?
Someone else whispered.
Many. Perhaps one came to be seen as a heretic and was removed by later generations of the devoted acolytes. Perhaps one was stolen by treasure seekers, though I find that hard to believe, given all that was left behind.
One of the guests began to read a small holographic plaque near the far wall for a visually impaired companion.
This collection of corpses is a monument to a long-dead civilization. Each corpse, each of these gene-givers, is now a museum artifact. But ages ago, they were living, breathing men and women. Beside each corpse rests small tokens of meaning from the deceased's life. At the end of the ancient ceremony, acolytes would have moved forward to gently dust these objects. Songs and prayers accompanied the tending of these organic monuments.
Toward the end of the ceremony, the docent said, calling all back to the center, the presider would have sung the names of the great dead. The Book of Rubrics indicates, let the presider speak or sing the names of the great dead. All the names shall be named. None shall be forgotten. The presider shall speak or sing all the names clearly and with tones of reverence. Now, if you can see, up on the dais, beside each corpse are marker stones long since unreadable. We have no idea of the names of these great dead, but the presider would have had no need of marker stones. Each presider sang the names of these long dead, long venerated bodies for many decades. Each learned the names. Each learned the songs from his grandfather before him. A question from one of the virtual users appeared on a small view screen by the door.
Why did the office skip a generation?
The docent nodded. We are not certain, nor do we know why the presiders were all male, despite the fact that members of any gender could, toward the end, serve in any other official political or religious role. A soft chime sounded, and the reenactors moved around the dais again, as if tending the blessed extractors, the engines of destiny.
This may be of interest, Docent said. It is recorded that new songs testifying to the work and legacy of the gene extractors were regularly composed by new generations of acolytes. You will see there beside each corpse are the remnants of ancient gene extractors. Long before the end, they had ceased to be used or usable, yet songs of blessing were sung over their moldering forms. Clearly, those too were revered monuments to a long-dead culture, millennia before the end.
A second soft chime sounded.
We must depart now.
The docent began to usher everyone back out the great wooden door. Ages ago, the recessional would have begun. The rituals complete, the veneration concluded. The presider would have sung the recessional, high-pitched tones resonating through the assembly hall. Acolytes would have retreated down steps to retake positions at the corners of the dais. The presider would have then descended, turned, and withdrawn from the chamber. Torchbearers would have followed close behind. The remaining acolytes would have come last. White, powdered faces would still be expressionless. Outside in the passageway, the docent took a quick count of the assembled organics, cybernetics, and probes. Then he ordered the great wooden door to be shut for another 2,800 rotations, just as it had been for eons beyond count. Chapter 8, The Haunting of Fleet Lieutenant Dijsonen. 634971. 634971 Gamma. 634971 Gamma, Frame 2. 634971 Gamma, Frame 2, Subsection 3. Fleet Lieutenant Digsonen stood silently in the personal hygiene cubicle of his apartment in the homeside barracks of Group Command, Inner System Battalion, 3rd Division. His bare feet tingled against the icy chill of the lightly textured, multi-hued ceramoglass floor. Real eyes met the gaze of reflected eyes in the highly polished walls of the cubicle as warm steam rose from the floor and cooler water misted over his body from the cubicle's three walls and ceiling. Digsonen's face was drawn, his hair disheveled. He could barely remember stumbling into the cubicle, but here he stood, memories of recent battle and emotional echoes of nightly dream terrors interweaving as he semi-consciously rubbed the most recent but rapidly mending scar running across his right shoulder with the two remaining organic fingers of his left hand. There was a dull pain behind his eyes and at his temples. He had not been getting adequate sleep. The sequences of numbers and words were coordinates, he knew that much, but they pointed in impossible directions. They were dangerous, and they put his life at risk. He knew that he must do something about them. Yet Digsonen was, for the moment, frozen in place, nearly unmoving, as water and steam washed war weariness and dream restlessness from the exterior of his body. Finally, wordlessly, he nodded his head three times, and the cybernetic systems in the cubicle responded and began to fire highly focused subsonic pulses at his back and shoulders. His muscles relaxed as the heat of the water and the sonic vibrations began to restore balance to his interior, too. Digsonen looked down from the reflection of his eyes and tried to purge his conscious mind of every thought except the shape and color of his beloved Mark VII exofighter. In his mind's eye, he saw himself run his hand across the vessel's belly, across the rungs of the ladder that he climbed to enter the cockpit, over the biomorphic controls and the complex neural interface. He meditated on the machine, its speed, its power, and his mind gradually came to rest. Having found some sense of peace, Digsonen softly said, "Terminate," and the water, steam, and sonic pulsing ceased. He stepped from the hygiene cubicle and reached for a towel hanging close by. He needed to shave, but he did not want to take the time to do so. "It can wait," he whispered. Digsonen slipped from his small lavatorium into the sleeping quadrant of his small apartment and pulled old civilian clothing from a compartment beneath his bunk, stuffed them into a common backpack, and then moved toward a wall-mounted cabinet to retrieve a simple military uniform. Once dressed and shod with a pair of his older pre-flight service boots, Digsonen slipped from the barracks apartment and began to make his way down the cold, quiet passageway toward the closest communal refectory. There had been celebrations long into the night, and the many empty bottles of alcohol and containers of consumed food were yet to be cleared from the refectory tables. In these last hours before dawn, however, enthusiasm for the well-fought victory dimmed even among the most hardy pilots, crew members, munitions engineers and officers, and support soldiers, who had finally returned to their bunks before the inevitable next engagement was announced. The result? This refectory was nearly empty, except for two Marines huddled together for a private conversation in one corner of the room, and a pilot snoozing off a drunken stupor in a chair by the doors to the room's public lavatoria. Dim nighttime lighting emitted by small orbs in the ceramoglass ceiling barely illuminated the walkways between tables and chairs. Several malfunctioning orbs clustered near the center of the ceiling were being mended by a small squadron of tiny mechanical technicians hovering in the air on the power of their micro-propellers. The machines took no notice of his organic presence. Beyond the refectory, Digsonen took the third service corridor and followed it for half a kilometer. He passed a few more drunken pilots asleep on each other's shoulders, empty containers littering the floor around them. An old maintenance unit scurried by on its remaining five functioning legs and headed back toward the refectory through which he had just passed. At the junction between the 3rd Service Corridor and the 5th Bypass Lane, Dijsonen finally crossed paths with a conscious human being. A security guard, junior grade, stepped aside and saluted him. Whether he saw Dijsonen's name on his identification badge or not, the soldier recognized his rank. It could not be helped. A fleet lieutenant could not move freely through these passages without his identification. Nevertheless, the fewer people who saw him, the better. He hurried past a security camera, his face purposefully turned downward. By the time Dijsonen reached the central sub-plaza of the Homeside Barracks, the broader community was beginning to awaken. He tried to move through the sub-plaza without making eye contact, confident that he'd be left alone by the majority of the military personnel in the vast space, since most were likely to be of lower rank than he was. He purposefully moved toward his left, toward the minor checkpoint to the exterior network of civilian passageways beyond the barracks. He had already decided to take the less well-guarded exit, even though that would require a more circuitous route through the civilian networks. As he approached the checkpoint, he unfastened his identification badge and handed it to the first checkpoint officer. "Good morning, Fleet Lieutenant," the second lieutenant greeted him with a salute. He slid the proffered identification card through a reader scanner and handed it back to Dijsonen. "Would you like to record a destination, sir?" "I'm heading out to meet a civilian contact for a meal, and perhaps more. It's her birthday." The lieutenant smiled and nodded. "Yes, sir." "Service pistol?" "Locked in my apartment. I am only carrying a service Stazer stick," Dijsonen said as he patted the side pocket of his service jacket. "Yes, sir. Registry number?" Dijsonen rattled off the identification number of his Stazer and then waited as the soldier recorded the information and cross-checked it against the barracks database. "Right," he finally said, looking up. "Please, sir, step through the scanner." Dijsonen took back his identification card, then stepped through the scanning systems and was cleared for departure. The two other soldiers guarding the checkpoint saluted, while an automated checkpoint electropulse cannon briefly deactivated as it registered the signal being emitted from his identification badge. Without further words, Dijsonen passed through the final portion of the checkpoint and into the first civilian passageway. 10 minutes of walking, with multiple turns, brought him into more heavily populated civilian corridors. He found what he was looking for, a small coffee shop that he regularly frequented, and he walked casually inside. The room was already filled with hungry and chatty patrons, enjoying coffee and watching the latest news or repeats of the week's entertainment from comm programs projected onto the walls or into their very midst as hollow screens. Dijsonen ignored the bright sheets of information laid in light, walked past the distribution counter, and ended up in the rear of the room. He waited for a few moments, feigning relaxed indifference while leaning against the wall of a small alcove in the back. Then, when he was convinced he had successfully blended in and no one was paying undue attention to him, Dijsonen slipped into the lavatorium. Once inside, the fleet lieutenant strode toward a particular stall, entered it, and locked the door behind him. Dijsonen slipped the backpack off and quickly changed into his civilian outfit. Then he folded his military uniform, placed it carefully in the backpack, and stashed the backpack inside a ventilation shaft in the ceiling above. He made certain his military identification badge was in the backpack before he closed the hatch. Then he attached a nondescript civilian identification badge to the front of his simple brown jacket and covered his military haircut with a well-worn, one might even say battered, cap. All exterior signs of profession and rank now excised or hidden, Dijsonen left the stall, lavatorium, and coffee shop, and headed deeper into the increasingly crowded passageways. He walked with stooped shoulders and bowed head, a stance he had long practiced in the years before his ascent into the military. All but the most skilled observers would have taken no notice of him now. After another half hour's walk, Dijsonen reached a civilian transport hub. There were several transport shuttles in various stages of preparation for launch. After paying for a ticket, the fleet lieutenant slipped through the closing doors of one of the transports and took a seat toward the rear of the vessel. The transport was full but not crowded, with about 3 dozen other passengers. Ijsonin scanned all of their faces quickly, but took note of only five. Two young civilian security officers, a pilot from the service, unknown to him, trying to settle down for a quick nap, a maintenance worker, this one organic, and a Corps representative. She was unmistakable in her highly polished boots, recently pressed battle dress pants, long ceremonial tunic, and distinguishing political officer's cap. Here was one who might see through his attempts to hide his true identity and, worse, his questionable intentions. The fleet lieutenant drew his mind into self-imposed emptiness and let his attention begin to slip. Barely conscious now, Ijsonin nevertheless knew that the Corps representative would have sensed the purposeful closing of one of the minds around her. Sure enough, he was barely aware of her as she looked up from her portable comm station and began to scan the space with her mechanically enhanced eyes. At that point, with what was left of his will, Ijsonin drifted more deeply into null meditation. As programmed by years of practice, his body moved into a cycle of seemingly random movements, an adjustment now and then in the seat to feign the desire for greater comfort, crossing and uncrossing of the ankles at random intervals, turning of the head to look at the signs overhead and then back toward the floor to stare, as if lost in thought. All the while his eyes remained open, but Ijsonin's conscious mind was empty. The Corps representative stared for an extended time at each of the passengers asleep or appearing to sleep, but none of those minds were completely closed. She then tried to assess the clearly wakeful individuals and their minds, but with so many around her, there was an indefinite psychic haze that wrapped around all of the other wakeful figures. As Ijsonin had hoped, she finally became frustrated by her inability to identify the mind blocked to her, and the Corps representative finally returned her attention to her comm station. 20 minutes later, exactly as trained, the fleet lieutenant's mind slipped back out of the null state and came back into basic awareness mode. He allowed the programmed physical mimicking patterns to persist for another 2 minutes, then took back over conscious gross motor functions. By then the transport shuttle had launched, climbed high into the planetary atmosphere, and emerged into space. Ijsonin could now feel the vessel turning, and he knew they were now heading toward the largest of the 7 space stations and artificial moons that orbited the planet. But here, where day and night were ill-defined, there was significant space traffic, far more than the atmospheric traffic that had been in flight above the day-rise hemisphere Ijsonin had just left. By the time the 33-minute trip and 4-minute docking procedure were completed, Ijsonin was in a bustling crowd of men, women, and machines swarming in and through another even larger civilian transport hub. He easily slipped past the Corps representative, who had been met at the foot of the transport's ramp by various governmental agents and a minor Corps cadet, then melted into the crowds. Once safely hidden from prying security cameras, Ijsonin removed his forged civilian identification badge and shoved it into an inner pocket of his jacket. He followed a group of civilian transport shuttle crew members just off from their shift and a lone and rather antique mechanized maintenance unit into the opening of a long corridor. A group of cyber priests processed in behind him, but they paid virtually no attention to place or people as they chanted their way down the corridor. Several older male civilians dressed in the ritual regalia of minor business functionaries also entered the corridor. It had been nearly 3 years since he had last been to the station, but Ijsonin was confident of the direction. Memory and cyber-enhanced cranial-embedded positioning systems co-confirmed that he was going the right way. 2 service corridors to the right, 1 to the left, another to the right, another to the left. This was it. He turned left, away from crew, priests, and businessmen. Only the maintenance unit turned into the corridor with him, and Ijsonin stepped aside and let it pass. He felt a measure of sympathy for the old machine as it limped along in front of him, partially dragging its left leg with each pair of steps. This particular corridor was lined with dozens of doorways. Many were open, and the sounds of cooking and rustling and preparations for the day spilled out.
This was a domestic zone, though without children, and for a moment Digsonan felt more at ease. 634971. 634971 Gamma. No. He shut his mind even more tightly and continued down the long corridor. In places the walls had been painted with street art or covered with propaganda slogans. Those from official sources had been defaced. In one or two places, old-fashioned paper signs had been posted, advertising all manner of goods and services, licit and otherwise. Digsonan paid them no mind. He began to count the doorways. Door 43B, he whispered. Door 45B. Door 47B. This one. The door that he had sought was conspicuously, though expectedly, shut. Digsonan hesitated, looked back over his shoulder, then further down the passageway in front of him. There was nothing visibly worrisome, so he tapped lightly on the metal door, then pressed the signal button. Nothing. And nothing still. He waited. He knocked more loudly and rang the button a second, and then a third time. Nothing. And still nothing. He waited and then knocked one last time. Finally, there was a stirring on the other side of the door. Digital locks were deactivated and the door opened a crack. "What do you want?" a raspy voice asked from the darkness on the other side. "My name is Tidij Gorat. I am an old friend of Keltu Koash. I need to speak to him."
"No one here by that name," snapped the voice behind the door.
The door began to shut.
"No, wait, please, I have cash."
The movement of the door ceased.
500,
the voice growled. "I have that," Digsonan said as he pulled several small crystalline rods, no larger than his thumbs, from his pocket. He slipped them through the door and dropped them into the unseen figure's hands. The latter took the rods and plugged them into a small neural interface above his right arm's elbow. There was a pause as brain and cybernetic interface scanned the rods for bank depository records. Finally satisfied, the figure snapped its fingers three times. Three small children, cash runners for the hidden figure, passed through the door. The figure handed them the rods, then snapped its fingers again. Off they ran to the nearest cash dispensary to collect the funds. "Well?" Digsonan asked, with just a purposeful edge of impatience in his voice. The figure in the shadows opened the door further and pulled the fleet lieutenant in.
This was an original work of music and text by Stan Pelkey. Please note that any unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, copying, or re-recording of this program, its story, or its music is an infringement of copyright.